We get things underway by welcoming back to the program one of our favorite guests on the show, journalist, author, and producer Josh Karpa. Josh, good to have you back. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing pretty well, thank you. Adjusting as we all are. Got to make those decisions on the fly from day to day.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, we'll cover a lot of ground today, but I wanted to start with Chevy Chase because I'm fascinated with him. He's got this reputation as being maybe not the nicest guy in the world, but I also, because I loved his work, particularly early on, I always hang on to some nuggets that I got, and I think it was on an old, maybe an old A&E biography special, where they went in some of the details of his family and his upbringing, a pretty tough relationship with his dad, so I've always kind of kept that in the back of my mind. What do you know? What's closer to the truth, or is it pretty much a gray area?
Yeah, you know, I think my experience with Chevy was all really positive. You know, he was very, very generous. He was super close to Doug Kenny, who I was writing about. And you know, my experience has been that not a lot of famous people are like to talk about anybody but themselves. When you're interviewing them, they're rarely like, you know, oh yeah, I'm prepared to talk about somebody else for half an hour. And Chevy was, you know, he was really close to Doug, and he was wonderful. I mean, he was really prepared to talk about Doug. He very clearly was somebody who really cared about him. And I mean, so my experience with him was that he was great to me, and he was very able to step out of being someone who had been a really big star, which is something I think never leaves most people, and talk about other people and care about talking about other people. You know, I know he had a very, very, very difficult childhood, even though he was raised in, I think, relative affluence. You know, somebody said something to me like, I can't remember who it was, but somebody who'd been involved with movies said something like, he's, you know, that derogatory term I won't use on your air, he said, but once you get past that, he really, really wants people to like him, and he doesn't know, he's not, you know, despite being charming, he's not great at making that happen. And so that's always what I kind of think about when I think about him. You know, he's, I think, you know, at heart, you know, very, a nice man. I liked him. You know, my experience may be very different from other people's, but, you know, I had a lot of empathy for him.
Well, I remember seeing him talk about, and his wife talk about him basically wanting to get out of Hollywood so he could raise his, I think all daughters, raise them in a fairly normal setting. And, man, he went up several notches in my estimation just based on that.
Yeah. I mean, from the people I've interviewed over the years, I think it's a really, I know you've interviewed plenty of people like this too. It seems to me like that's a very disorienting experience to be as famous as somebody like Chevy was. And, you get to a certain point where, you grow up and you think like, oh, who could have a hard time with that? Right. Everybody loves you. You're making all kinds of money. You know, wherever you go, people think you're great. And then, you know, you get to be a certain, you know, to a certain point in your life, and you're like, oh my God, that sounds awful. You know, because you can't go anywhere, and everybody, you know, you don't know who's, you know, being honest with you. And my experience has been that a lot of the famous people I've interviewed seem extremely lonely. You know, I think once you no longer have to pick up your own dry cleaning, that's like the turning point, you know, where things get really weird, and it's not like being a person anymore. So, yeah, he was somebody who made the choice to get away from all that.
I wanted to ask him, I didn't mention this ahead of time, but I was thinking about it, and in your wonderful book about National Lampoon, one of the most interesting characters not named Doug Kenny is Henry Beard. Can you talk a little bit about him?
Yeah, you know, Henry was, he was like the great and mysterious Oz when I was working on the book, because everybody, Henry was you know, for, you know, people who don't know him, he was one of the two guys, essentially, who, you know, started National Lampoon along with Doug Kenny. And Henry was, you know, from this old money, you know, East Coast family. I can't remember if he went to Taft or what boarding school he went to. I remember he, at some point, I think, like, or maybe it was, he went to Harvard as a rebellion against everybody going to Yale in his family.
Like you do.
An outrageous act by a teenager. And he had a relative, I think, who'd, been a candidate for vice president. You know, they owned woolen mills in some far-off part of Canada. I mean, he was real old-fashioned East Coast WASP, big money stuff. And, you know, and he is a brilliant guy, extremely organized, extremely disciplined. And he met up with Doug Kenny, who was, you know, this wildly brilliant guy who was everything, you know, that Henry, he and Henry were like, you know, they're kind of comedic opposites. Doug knew, you know, was not from that kind of background. He knew, you know, what, you know, going to the prom and being just a regular American kid was. And he, and Doug was, you know, wild. I mean, he was disorganized. He did everything at the last minute. He was undependable. And the two of them formed this incredible, you know, partnership at National Lampoon. But Henry really was the guy. If Doug, you know, made the magazine work from a content standpoint, Henry was the guy who made it work. He was overseeing possibly the most difficult staff of employees that has ever been assembled anywhere. I was talking to somebody about this the other day, and one of the guys who worked there said that, you know, they'd have these morning editorial meetings, and it was one of my favorite lines. He said, he goes, it was like the kind of stuff people are talking about in mental hospitals, except we were getting paid. And, you know, I mean, that's kind of what it was. You know, they, you know, Henry was presiding over this totally, totally insane group of people, and he was the one who had to hold it together because nobody else was going to. So he made sure the magazine got out. He's a brilliant parrot. He could do anything. Like I remember he wrote a parody of like a hard-boiled detective novel with a woman as the protagonist, which in 1973 was, you know, oh my God, right? Like, you know. And I remember it was called, like, My Gun is Cute. And it was, like, perfect. It was exactly like Dashiell Hammett or, you know, Raymond Chandler, except from a, you know, kind of stereotypical 1973 female perspective. So Henry was a brilliant guy, but when he and Doug, you know, got bought out of the Lampoon in 75, I think, he
it wasn't exactly an emotional goodbye for him, was it?
No. He never spoke to me when I was working on the book because, you know, it was a lot, you know, I had come along at a time where people were just starting to talk about this again. And he just refused, and which was fine. And I think was helpful to me in a way because I could kind of understand him and, you know, not feel intimidated by this guy who was, you know, like the Great Oz. Right. But yeah, he got his check, and everybody was waiting in his office. And I believe he walked back in. He opened up his briefcase. He stuck his, you know, $3.5 million 1975 check in his briefcase, closed it, and said, "I haven't felt this relieved since I was released from the army." And he walked out, and he didn't talk to anybody for 3.5 years.
Wow. If you're gonna leave, go out in style. There, we're talking with Josh Karp.
He had a great line going out.
Yes, he did. Now we can, I don't know, we can edit this out later if you want to say it.
It's okay.
All right. Read it in the book. It'd be even better there. We were chatting about some of the crew from Animal House, which remains such a touchstone in film comedy in the last 40 plus years. And that's such an interesting crew there that have gone on to varying levels of success along the way, but few people have worked as much and as consistently as the guy who played maybe the most mysterious character in the film D-Day, Bruce McGill.
Yeah, he was another guy, you know, I had interviewed enough people that I did not I didn't need to talk to him. So I kind of, you know, did not. But he, what a great, you know, and kind of certainly at the moment, you know, you'd never be like, he was great as D-Day. And you thought, you'd think he'd be that character for the rest of his life. But he's, you know, just gone on to have such a great, great career playing a really, you know, a wide variety of characters. I mean, he's obviously, you know, he's the definitive kind of character actor, but he, I always think of him in The Insider, when he played the attorney who's helping, you know, prosecute the tobacco executive. And I you know, can't remember exactly, but he has a great scene where a big tobacco executive is kind of smirking at him in the courtroom, and he just slaps the guy down, you know, in the most, in the almost like, you know, incredibly moving way when you're watching the film. He's a wonderful actor, and he can do kind of, you know, he's a physical type, which I think probably restricts a lot of people, but he can kind of do anything. He's a good guy, he's a bad guy, you know, he's funny, he's serious, he can do pretty much anything. Yeah. I love seeing him.
I loved him in Cinderella Man. I thought he was great in that.
Oh, right, I forgot about that. Yeah, no, he was terrific in that, and he was great as a not great movie, but he was great in The Legend of Bagger Vance. He played Walter Hagen.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, another guy who's been very busy, and he's done quite well, and he's been on with us a couple of times, a really nice guy, Tim Matheson, who has been successful as an actor and a director, but not so successful for a time when he actually briefly owned the Lampoon.
Yeah, you know, I remember when that actually happened when I was younger. You know, I just remember because, I mean, I was not, you know, a great student of what was going on with the Lampoon at that time. And I was like, oh my God, Otter bought the Lampoon. And he found, you know, much to his credit, he's one of the few people who bought the Lampoon who did not wind up in jail after the original owners. I think two successive sets of owners wound up in jail. And one who I dealt with wound up in jail. He's, you know, I always was kind of amazed that he didn't become a really big star because, you know, he's got all that kind of leading man stuff, you know, incredibly handsome. And he's had a great career, but, you know, and he's handsome, he's charming, he can act. And yeah, I'm always, you know, sad I don't see him in more things and bigger parts.
And another guy who's been keeping pretty busy through the years is Peter Riegert.
Oh, I love him. He's so good in everything. I mean, I remember, I think the first time I saw him after Animal House was in that movie Local Hero. Do you remember that?
I do. Yeah, that was a wonderful movie.
Oh, it was a great movie. And he, you know, he plays a guy who gets an oil executive who gets sent to a small town in Scotland by a really eccentric boss played by Burt Lancaster, oddly enough.
Right.
And and he's great. And he just shows up, you know, he's like one of those people who's always, you know, just like one of those comfortable presences whenever, you know, he comes on the screen. And was he on Damages? I think he was really menacing on something, and I think it might have been Damages. He's great. I you know, Peter Riegert's always terrific, and then I always loved him in Crossing Delancey with Amy Irving.
And we had, his girlfriend in the film, Karen Allen, we had on the show a couple of years ago. It could not have been nicer. She's not out of the business completely. She directed a short film a couple of years ago, but she also owns her own fiber arts business over in Vermont now. And I can't even imagine what it must have been like your first time in a movie surrounded by that crew making Animal House.
Oh, right? No, she was, you know, it's funny. I ran into her at O'Hare Airport about 2 years after the book came out. And we were both at the same baggage carousel. And she was another person who I had not been able to catch up with, and I walked up to her and I said, you know, hi, you know, my name is Josh Karp. I wrote a book about Doug Kenny, you know, and I included Adam. And she's, you know, and she was really nice. And meanwhile, looking at me like I was absolutely secretly, she was like, oh my God, he's out of his mind, you know. And then she was actually, that experience also was my, both she, I met her, and I met Annette O'Toole, who was in the movie version of Futile and Stupid Jester. And the one thing I learned with both of them is I had this, and I'm not this kind of person, but I had this huge instinct to tell both of them and say, you know, like, I loved you when I was 12 years old.
Yes. I didn't hold back. I just said it to them, but to both of them. Because I have no pride.
No, it wasn't even that. It was, I was like, you know, I'm not sure they want to hear that from, you know, a guy my age. Like, I wasn't embarrassed to say it. I was like, they might not think that's a compliment at this point. She was great. She was so nice when I met her. She was terrific. And I was genuinely in love with her as a child.
Absolutely. We're talking with Josh Karp here on Downtown. All right, I want to switch subjects here and talk about a film that, well, not just you and I, but I think a lot of people look at as not just one of the great films of the 70s, but one of the great sports movies ever made, The Bad News Bears.
Oh, yeah. I watched it. You know, I have four kids, all boys, and we were, during the quarantine, straining for things to watch. And we thought, oh, yeah, let's watch The Bad News Bears. And I hadn't seen it. I mean, I saw it a million times when it came out. It was like my Star Wars. You know, like when everybody was, all my friends were seeing Star Wars like 40 times, I went to see Bad News Bears like 20. And it was, you know, what was really interesting to me was just how good a movie it is.
Yes, did you find it was darker than you remembered?
Oh my God, not only just darker, I mean, like, I drove my wife out of her mind with all of my post-viewing insights into the emotional complexity of The Bad News Bears. But it really, to me, first of all, I mean, it was, those kids were the age I was at that time. You know, I was born in 66, so that was like, right, you know, I was 10 years old, they might have been 12. And it was such an accurate depiction of the world at that time and of what it was to be a kid at that time. Oh, and But what was really interesting, I remember always thinking, you know, and I've coached baseball and you know, other sports, and you know, the Vic Morrow character.
Oh my God.
Always the great example, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The worst dad in the world. And then I watched it, and he's still awful. Yet there are these weird, you know, when the reason he winds up hitting his kid, which, you know, I do not endorse, but is because he's up the last straw as his son throws another kid's head. And you kind of go like, huh, that's weird. You know, like, that's actually like kind of not the worst reason to, you know, to be upset in that situation. And there's also a weird, really weird moment where he, you know, the character played by Jackie Earle Haley, Kelly Lee, who's like, you know, at the time, the coolest guy anybody my age had ever seen.
Exactly.
Where he throws him out he's sitting on the stands or something, and he throws him out, and they have this confrontation, and all of a sudden you see Vic Morrow looks at him and their eyes lock, and he's being just an awful dickhead to him. And you go like, oh my God, he totally is looking at him like, I'm really sorry I'm doing this. You know, there's like this weird thing that you don't see in movies anymore. Like, no, you know, there's like, I hate to say this about The Bad News Bears, there's like this real complexity to the characters. I was talking to somebody, and there's the scene where, you know, Tanner, who's like everybody's favorite character, you know, gets beat up by the kids who are picking on the kid he picks up. And they have this weird moment. You're just kind of like, you're like, wow, this is so much more, you know, about what it is to really be a kid and what it is to really be an adult in that situation. So I love that movie. I mean, I just love it.
And there's so many wonderful things about it. One of the best is that they don't win the game. They don't win the championship, because that would have been that Hollywood ending.
Absolutely. And that the movie ends, you know, like it's, you know, movies all have four endings now.
Right.
You know, I mean, there would, you know, but it literally, they lose the game, they, you know, throw the trophy, and then they pour beer all over each other's heads, and it's over. you know, today there would have, you know, I don't know what would have happened, but we would have seen them all go home. We would have heard, you know, talk to their parents. You know, we watched, not to switch movies, but we watched The Sting the other night. And that's another movie where it's like, you know what? They just ended it where it was supposed to end. They just, you know, have the bad guy come back for one more run at them, you know, to catch them. So, yeah, I love the end of Bad News Bears. And I think it's something you never see, because absolutely they would have won today.
Hey, have you seen this story about, I guess it's Billy Eichner going to play Paul Lynde in a biopic? Why am I fascinated by that? Is it just because of my addiction to Hollywood Squares back in the day?
You know, I saw that too. And that's, first of all, for somebody, you know, who you know, does what I do, it was great, because I was like, well, you know what? Anything I ever want to pitch somebody that seems weird and obscure,
and now it's possible.
I could be like, there's a friggin' Paul Lynde biopic. Really? you're having trouble with the Ken Stabler story, you know, whatever weird thing comes out of your mouth. You know, it's just like, you know, I mean, I think it's great. I think, you know, it, first of all, I don't even know where it's going to air, but I think there's this great, one of the great benefits of streaming is that there's now, you know, you just, because something is narrow, if it's good and if people are interested, it has a home, you know, and so many projects that never would have happened 10 years ago.
Right, right.
If you're going through studios, you know, are happening. So yeah, Paul Lynde. Oh my God.
Well, and I wonder how deep they'll go, because I was listening to Gilbert Gottfried's podcast a while back, and he was telling horror stories about how awful Paul Lynde was to people on Hollywood Squares. And part of that was, I think, because of alcohol and God knows what else was going on in his life, but was not a well-loved guy by a lot of the people he came into contact with, at least late in his career.
Yeah, you know, I always think about, you know, I lived, you know, kind of just north of Chicago, and Evanston, I'm near Evanston, which is where Northwestern is. And he is a Northwestern graduate. And I think he was like he was Grand Marshal of the Homecoming Parade one year, which my parents, I'm sure, never thought like, oh, Paul Lynde's Grand Marshal, let's, you know, take Josh to see that. But I really wish that had been one of my childhood experiences. You know, like, oh, yeah, Paul Lynde's during the Homecoming Parade. You're the Big Ten school. Why not? But he, there was some really crazy incident where he drunkenly showed up late at night at the Burger King in Evanston, which is the only Burger King in Evanston, so I know exactly where it is. And I can't remember the details, and it was somewhat sketchy, but I'm just like, that would have been a Burger King to be at.
Oh, God, yeah.
When Paul Lynde is on a drunken rant at a Burger King, it's not your average drunken Burger King rant.
That's where you want to be, right there.
Yeah, that is the place to be that night and maybe that month.
I love it. Hey, Josh, it is always good to catch up with you. I appreciate you making time for us this afternoon. Stay safe. Watch where you go on the road, and we'll do it again before too long.
Look forward to it. And thank you for letting me talk about Paul Lynde. My God, that might be my only opportunity. So thank you.
All right. We'll see you, Josh.
Take care, Rich.